Now, the U.S. Supreme Court weighed in on the Electoral College system last week. In a unanimous ruling, the court decided states are allowed to require members of the Electoral College to vote for the candidates they had pledged to support. That would stop electors from many states from being so-called faithless electors. A handful of electors cast votes for candidates other than Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton back in 2016. Barry Burden is a political science professor at UW-Madison. He's also director of the Elections Research Center. Barry, welcome back to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
Well, tell us a little more about what this ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court actually means.
Well, the ruling dealt with two cases, one from Washington State and one from Colorado, that had different conclusions. So the court wanted to solve this problem and reconcile the cases before we get too close to the November election. Their ruling, which, as you said, was unanimous, gave state legislatures the right to bind electors so that they must follow the popular vote. Legislatures are given the power to determine electors really any way they want by the U.S. Constitution. About two-thirds of them decide that the popular vote is the guiding factor, and the justices have said that's just fine. But, of course, the states are not required to do that, and there are, I think, 19 states that don't have those kinds of rules in place.
So without this kind of rule, an elector, once they show up vote at the Electoral College, could theoretically be a free agent. And as I mentioned, we saw a few of those. Some Hillary Clinton voters voted for Bernie Sanders or others. I think some Donald Trump electors voted for Colin Powell, if I'm remembering correctly, some combination of that. This means that it would be harder for electors in those states that have those guidelines to do something like that.
That's right. It doesn't happen very often, especially after the, say, 1800s. But there are these stray cases where electors go rogue, and that's what produced these two cases that went to the Supreme Court. But as I mentioned, there's still a number of states that would allow electors to go rogue because they don't have a law in place or a penalty that would require them to follow the popular vote. And, you know, some of the founders, Hamilton and Madison and some of the others who wrote the Federalist Papers, might think that's a good thing. They wanted the Electoral College to have some independence, to not be made of politicians and to not be made of regular people or to be guided solely by public opinion or by popular votes. But the court recognized in its ruling last week that for all intents and purposes, states have effectively decided that the popular vote should be the determining factor. And so if they want to have that be the rule, they can make electors follow it.
Why did we make the move? I mean, I think I get the reasoning, but how did we make the move from the idea that we're electing not a president, but electors who will then elect the president, to the electors being mostly just a formality?
It took a while for that to happen. I think this may be surprising to people who assume it's always been like this, but in the early days of the United States, the assumption was that the Electoral College would be quite independent, and the electors might actually be chosen on a district-by-district basis, rather than on a winner-take-all statewide basis. It wasn't really until the mid-1800s that the states began to adopt the popular vote as the way to determine how their electors would be sent to the state capitol in December to vote. And it was really, I think, the late 1800s when the final state decided to adopt that. And now every state but Maine and Nebraska use the popular vote and use winner-take-all to determine their slate of electors. Maine and Nebraska, I think, are nice examples that it's not required of states to do this. Both of those states allocate the electors by congressional district and then have two statewide electors to the winner of the statewide vote. And Maine is actually going to be using ranked choice voting this fall, plus this district-based system to choose its electors. So there is a lot of room for experimentation in the states. They've just chosen, as of 150 years ago or so, to converge on this idea of the popular vote.
We're talking to Barry Burden, political science professor at UW-Madison and director of the Elections Research Center, looking at a U.S. Supreme Court decision on electors saying, yeah, states, you can require your electors to vote for the candidate they were pledged by voters to vote for. They can't, if states require that, they can't go off on their own. Barry, I know some people had a campaign in 2016 trying to get faithless electors to, in effect, thwart the election of Donald Trump. And I think there have been efforts like that in the past. They never seem to go very far. Is there ever a situation in the modern era where faithless electors could actually switch the outcome of a presidential election?
Short answer is no. It doesn't look like maybe there's ever been a case where the faithless electors have actually changed the outcome. They have raised some uncertainty, and you know, I think Trump had enough of a margin that he could lose a few electors and still be above the 270 mark that's needed to win the Electoral College. But you know, electors in recent years have been chosen mostly by state political parties, and they are chosen for their loyalty. It's in many states a reward for good party behavior. Someone who's been an elected official or maybe an activist, a donor, maybe the chair of the state Republican or Democratic Party, they get selected as electors as kind of an honorary position. So they're proud to do it and in most cases are enthusiastic about the nominee for their party. So there's little risk that they're going to be rogue and bump up against the party. 2016 was a little different because you had two nominees who weren't beloved by all of the party rank and file. And despite that, there were only about six electors who didn't do exactly what the popular vote told them they should do.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Andrew is with us in Palmyra. Andrew, hi.
Hey, how are you guys doing today?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Andrew?
So I just wanted to ask the guest a question about when he's referring to the popular vote, is he talking about the popular vote on a national scale, or is he talking about the popular vote within a state? Everybody in Wisconsin, as far as the majority is concerned, voted for a Republican candidate, but the electors decided to do something else as far as how they decide. Are you talking about the popular vote on the national scale, or are you talking about within the state?
Andrew. And that's a great point of clarification. Barry, what we were talking about at that point was at the state scale, that the electors have to go with the popular vote of Wisconsin or Colorado or whatever the state might be. That said, Barry, some people want to change that to do the other thing that Andrew was pointing toward, have electors have to follow the national popular vote. Can you talk about that movement?
Yeah, it really is worth clarifying these two different levels that we're talking about, the state-based voting and then the national vote. Right now, it's quite possible for the national popular vote to go for one candidate and the Electoral College vote to go for another. That happened in 2016. Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by a couple million votes. Donald Trump won the Electoral College. He goes to the White House. It also happened in 2000. So it's happened twice in the last five elections where different candidates won each. The electoral votes right now are allocated state by state, where each state sends a slate of electors for the party that won the most votes in its state. Doesn't have to be a majority, just more than the other side. Trump won more votes than Hillary Clinton in Wisconsin, but it wasn't quite a majority. That didn't matter. You win by one vote or you win by a million, you get all the state's electors. There is a proposal out there that would make the Electoral College follow the national popular vote. It's something called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. It's a long name, but it's basically an agreement among the states where they would all sign on and agree to give their Electoral College votes to whoever won the national popular vote, regardless of what happened in their state. If enough states sign on to this agreement, it would have to be enough states that they control at least a majority of the electors, then it would go into effect and could be used for an upcoming presidential election. There are a lot of questions about this compact, whether it's constitutional, whether states would stick to it once they signed on if they didn't like the result. But in theory, if a state like Wisconsin joined the compact, we would give our 10 electoral votes to whoever won the national popular vote, regardless of what happened in our state. And that ought to encourage the candidates to go on a nationwide campaign rather than focusing on 5 or 10 swing states.
We're talking to political scientist and elections expert Barry Burden from UW-Madison about a recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling allowing states to hold faithless electors accountable and about some calls to elect a president via the popular vote, in effect, rather than the Electoral College. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about that? Should electors, once they're picked, should they be free agents allowed to switch their vote if they want to, or should states be able to lock them in? Should presidents be elected by the nationwide popular vote by one mechanism or another? Or do you like the system with electoral votes, even though it may mean that the popular vote winner, as has happened a couple times in recent years, doesn't necessarily get to be president? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the U.S. Supreme Court ruling that allows states to penalize electors who don't vote for the candidate they pledged to support in presidential elections. Barry Burden is with us, political science professor at UW-Madison, also director of the Elections Research Center. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about this ruling, about the role of electors? Do you want to see a switch one way or another to electing the president via popular vote? Whoever gets the most votes wins the election, or do you like the Electoral College where it is? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go back to your calls now. Tom is with us in Lake Tomahawk. Tom, hello.
Hello. It's been years since I earned my Citizenship in the Nation merit badge in Scouts, and I also didn't get to hear the beginning of this show, so I hope this isn't repetitive. But I have friends who advocate for abolishing the Electoral College and going just with a nationwide popular vote, and I wonder if the speaker could talk about some of the pros and cons for that, of that, especially as it would affect larger, more populous states and less populous states. And I'll take the comments off the air. Thanks
a lot for bringing that up. And we heard from Ellen on Facebook who says, keep it as it is. It protects us in the flyover states from being run by the elitists on the coasts. And that's a concern we hear often when people talk about national popular vote, that candidates would spend all their time in the places with the most people.
Well, you do hear that. I guess I want to challenge that in a couple of ways. So let's imagine there's a popular vote, and now the winner of the election is the one who gets the most votes nationwide. There would definitely be an incentive to go to large urban areas, places like Chicago and Dallas and Boston, that are right now totally ignored by candidates because they're not in swing states. And it probably would mean that a state like Iowa, which right now gets a lot of attention because it's a swing state, would get less because the population is smaller. And Wisconsin, for that matter, might get less. But I think it's wrong to think that candidates would only go to big cities, or that maybe this would advantage Democrats because they do better in cities. After all of our states elect statewide offices like governor. And in those elections, the candidates don't only go to the big cities. We just had a governor's election here in Wisconsin a year and a half ago. And I don't think we would say that Scott Walker and Tony Evers only campaigned in Milwaukee and Madison. They were forced to get all over the state, to run ads in all the media markets, to cultivate different constituencies around the state. And that would be the case in a national popular vote as well. Republicans would want to go to suburbs in Texas, but also the outskirts of Chicago and into parts of even blue states like Massachusetts. There are Republicans everywhere. So it would, I think, change campaigning in a pretty dramatic way. And voters who live in places like California would start to see the candidates, and us in Wisconsin would have a little less time with them and see a somewhat fewer of their ads. You know, right now there's a real inequality because the presidential campaign is fought in 5 or 10 states, and voters in those states get bombarded with activity, and their turnout levels are higher than in states that are the so-called blackout states, where one party is likely to win really easily. And that just seems to violate our idea that candidates ought to be out there trying to win the votes of all the voters.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Barry now in Rice Lake. Barry, hello.
Yeah, hello. I just was just thinking more about the popular vote statement and that compact. And the flaw in that is every state's got an automatic recount provision. Or if there was a close election on the national vote, it would be impossible to do a recount, especially when all the states have different rules and laws and regulations. So that couldn't happen if you had a close election like we have a tendency to have.
Thanks for that call. A close popular vote, national election demanding all states do a recount potentially. Barry Burden, what do you think?
Well, that's a real concern. I appreciate that coming up. There are a few issues that I think complicate a national popular vote. One is that there could be a very close national race that requires a nationwide recount. I think that's highly unlikely because it would mean that the national votes would add up for both parties in such a way that there's essentially a nationwide tie. It's much more likely that would happen in a single state, as was the case in Florida back in 2000, or several states, including Wisconsin, that were very close in 2016. So it's possible, but I think it's very remote as a concern. There are some other worries, like the eligibility for voting varies from one state to another. So in some places, if you've had a criminal conviction, you can never vote again. But in other states, you can actually be in jail or in prison and have the right to vote. So there is going to be some inequality in who's eligible. And if we are going to add up all the votes from all the states, it may be that some states have an incentive to try to make more people eligible to vote to help their side in a partisan way. I don't think that's a terrible thing for the states to have a battle over trying to enfranchise more voters, but it is something to be attentive to. There is one other upside we want to mention, and that is about election security and hacking. Right now, foreign actors have a real incentive to try to infiltrate key swing states like Wisconsin, Florida, North Carolina, because messing with those states in one place could disrupt the whole national system. It's less likely that a foreign actor could do that sort of thing with a national popular vote, because even if they toy with a polling place or a website in North Carolina, it's unlikely to affect the national totals in a significant way. So there are some real trade-offs, but I think the benefits outweigh the costs.
Thanks for that call. Barry, just a few seconds left. A very brief answer. Do you think we'll see a popular vote for president in our lifetime?
I think it's a possibility. Many people won't remember this, but we got very close to doing away with the Electoral College back in 1969 and 1970. The idea actually passed the House of Representatives, was endorsed by President Nixon, and only got hung up in the Senate. So I think there could be a movement in that direction, but it will require people on both sides of the aisle to come together to make that possibility.
Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's political scientist Barry Burden from UW-Madison talking about the recent Supreme Court ruling on the Electoral College process.